Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hey everyone, Jesse Green here. Welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast, the show where great dentistry meets great business. In today's episode, it's an absolute joy to be having a conversation with my friend, my colleague, Dr. Les Jabbour. Les runs a fantastic practice at the Gold Coast, and although you may not see him much on social media, he just goes about his day doing his thing, building a strong and robust practice. Les's journey at his practice began at a very young age, firstly as a patient, then as an associate, then as a partner, and now as the sole owner of Define Dental. And one of the things that I really like about this conversation is Les reflects on that journey and shares some of the things that have worked really well for him, but equally is willing enough to share some of the things that he got wrong along the way, some of the things that caught him unawares and what he's had to do to get back on track. Les is a really insightful guy. He's got an ability to self-reflect, an ability to look upstream for the root cause of an issue and solve it rather than the symptom. So when it comes to business, his business is always evolving, always improving, and it's no wonder that he's enjoying tremendous success up at the Gold Coast. As I said, he's incredibly generous with his knowledge and his insights, so I'd encourage everyone listening to have a pen and paper handy because some of the lessons that he shares in this are really applicable to anyone in business and particularly for those who are looking to grow quickly in their practice, just as Les has done. It's such a pleasure and a privilege to have Les on our podcast. He's someone who I admire, someone who I really respect, and someone I have the pleasure to work with on a regular basis. So without any further ado, here's Dr. Les Jabbour. Les Jabbour, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your evening, actually, to come and hang with us. How's things with you, mate?
Yeah, really good. Thanks, Jesse. Had a big day, but all's well, mate.
Cool, cool. Mate, I've been looking forward to this podcast for quite a while, and there's a lot of things that I'd love to talk to you about tonight. But before we get into the nitty-gritty, the nuts and bolts, the meat and potatoes, and any other metaphor I can think of, I wanted to just see if we can give people a bit of a picture about your practice, because you've got a lot of really good things happening at Define Dental. And I just wondered if you could give us a little bit of an overview of where you're up to in your practice journey, a little bit of a story of how you got to be where you are, and then we'll take it from there.
Depends how deep you want me to go, mate. I'll give you the short version. You can dwell deeper if you want to. I started off as a patient there. It was originally called Surface Paradise Dental Center. Sure enough, they were located in Surface Paradise. I can still remember going there as a kid in primary school. My dad dropping me off because there was nowhere to park the car, and I had to walk up through an arcade and up a flight of stairs to get to the reception. As a young kid, it was a bit daunting seeing yourself in and doing the things that had to be done to go to the dentist, but sure enough, that's how my parents led the way. Over the years, they moved from Surface Paradise to a suburb called Benowa, built some purpose-built premises, and I continued as a patient. I remember being in high school. I was trying to decide what I want to do when I finished school, and I had to go in there and I had a filling done by one of the dentists, Dr. Phil Foster, who's retired now. And I remember his nurse Karen, and I remember sort of laying in the chair and having it done and just sort of having a look at Karen mixing the materials and Dr. Foster, his first name's Phil, doing his bit. And I just remember thinking, oh, that's not too bad. That's something I could see myself doing.
Cool.
As I got towards the end of high school, I went and approached him and said, you know, this is something I'm thinking of doing. What do you reckon? And he encouraged me. I put it down as one of my preferences when I left high school, and I was lucky enough and blessed enough to get in. Did the course through uni. And then one of the other dentists was actually one of the demonstrators or tutors at university, Dr. Edward Cowie. And he used to demonstrate one of the clinics. It was called Comprehensive Dental Care. We did everything. Dr. Ian Myers was in charge of that.
Yeah, I remember those days.
Yeah. And after I graduated, I did actually work at a couple of different places. I worked another couple of private clinics, and I worked at a couple of government clinics too, actually, for a few years. And then on my RDOs, I found myself having a little bit of extra time. And the funny story is my sister was a hairdresser and she was cutting Buzz's hair, he's one of the dentists. And he said, I'll tell him to come down, we'll get him some to work with us on the RDAs and his Saturdays. So sure enough, I went down there and started working. One thing led to another, and then it sort of got to the stage where I was working in the government. I sort of, what's the word? I'm looking for the right word. I basically wanted to go private, and I approached the guys. There was three of them. I talked about Dr. Foster, Dr. Cow, and there was a Dr. Gardner at the time. And I just made them an offer where I wanted to come in and work, and they had a spare treatment room there. I said, just give me the room, get me a nurse. You don't have to pay me anything. Just give me a commission, which was the standard rate at the time. And away I went. After a year, my books were full. After, well, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years, one of the older, there was a three-way partnership, one of the older guys. So I started off as an employee, a sort of associate. Myself as a patient, actually.
Yeah, well, that's exactly then, right.
Then the employee, associate, one of the other guys retired, and I bought in. I built up my own goodwill at that stage. Bought into the practice then as one of the partners. And as time went by and were approached by one or two corporates and decided that wasn't the way we wanted to go. But at the same time, the older two dentists, Dr. Cow, Dr. Foster, wanted to look at their exit strategies, and sure enough, I was a big part of that. So I went from being their employer to from their employee to their associate, and after a short time, their employer. They were seeing the last few years out.
That's quite the journey, mate. And it reminds me of that ad on TV. I liked it so much, I bought the company, and yeah, it's kind of worked out well. So there's a lot of threads in there, Les, that I'd really just love to just pull on, because there'll be a lot of people listening to this podcast who might be going, wow, that's a hell of a journey. And it is a hell of a journey. And what I'm curious to ask you about was, how hard was it to go in manage that relationship all the way through? Because there's been a point where you've been the patient, you've been the part-time junior associate on the weekends, and you've kind of been the full-time associate, then you've been a partner, then an employer. So there's the shifting sands around those relationships. I'm curious to ask you, as time progressed, how did you adapt to those new roles? How did you adapt to those new relationships? And I'm sure those guys that you worked with were all lovely, lovely fellas, but I can imagine there must have been just a bit of getting used to it all for everyone.
Yeah, there's not a doubt about that. I can still remember one of my first disciplinary conversations with Phil, where he's sort of typing, and you can't run late, you got to be on time, and a couple of little housekeeping rules that go along with that. And the shift to associate, where you're taking a certain level of responsibility and risk. So, you know, sure enough, we saw a lot of good months. We saw some bad months too. We had to shoulder some of that risk. And there were times there where we didn't get paid. Thank goodness it wasn't too many, but they were there. And the shift, the biggest and hardest shift was probably at a point in time where, you know, the corporates did have a quick look at the practice, and we decided, no, that wasn't the way we wanted to go. It wasn't the way I wanted to go for my future. And that's when I had to make the call. Ultimately, the other guys knew that they were getting towards the end, the part of their career. At the time, I had certain family commitments. So all of a sudden, there's a certain degree of risk or a gamble that you've got to take, you've got to back yourself, I suppose. And that was probably the hardest bit, getting my mind around going, okay, I can do this, I can take this responsibility, and I would rather have this responsibility on my shoulders than be at the mercy of somebody else.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I'm curious to ask you, Les, because, again, there'll be tons of people listening to this podcast who might be at that point where they've got to take that leap of faith. And there is that leap of faith. It's kind of like running from first base to second base. For a moment in time, you're on neither base, right? And you're kind of thinking, do I keep running forward to second base, or do I go back to what I know? And that's first base, which could be back to an employment situation, whatever. I'm curious to ask you, what gave you the courage to run through to second base? What was it that allowed you to have the intestinal fortitude, the self-belief, to take that leap of faith and go, you know what, I'm going to back myself on this? What was it that you found within yourself to be able to do that?
I suppose one of the first things was I always knew I wanted to work for myself. Ever since being a young kid even before I knew I wanted to do dentistry, I knew that I sort of wanted to be my own boss. And that was obviously the path that would lead to that. The other part of it, I suppose, was that crunch time came when the call had to be made. It was me or somebody else. So I was kind of, I wasn't cornered, but there just comes a point in time where you got to make the call and then you got to commit to it. That's it. You got to take your foot off first base and start running to second.
And run like hell.
I know that's hard, but and you got to expose yourself to get there, but you just got to let go and run with it and go for it.
Cool. So when you actually got to second base and you're in your own show and you, by this stage, you're now the sole owner of what was then Surfers Paradise Dental Center, now known as Define Dental. What were some of the early challenges you had when you took over the practice? What were a couple of the things where you just went, wow, I didn't see that coming? Because my experience taking over practice is you have all these things in your mind you think are going to happen and you plan for some contingencies and all the rest of it, but then all of a sudden something out of left field happens and you go, I didn't see that coming. That was not in my business plan. I'm wondering, what was it that you might have caught you unawares on your journey?
I suppose the biggest thing that comes to mind, that's a really good question. There's many things you could talk about, but the biggest thing that comes to my mind was, so there was a point in time when there were three partners helping each other, helping the business move forward and do what was required to meet the needs of the workplace. There was a sizable, I can't remember the number of staff, but, you know, let's call it 8 or 9 support staff and 1 or 2 dentists, as well as the partner dentists. So let's say, I can't remember the exact numbers, but let's say there were 3 partners and 10 support staff or clinical staff. You had a ratio there of, let's say, 3 to 1, roughly. And then all of a sudden, when you became, I started flying, so I went from 3 to 1 to sort of 1 to 13. 10 or 11. And with that, the level of responsibility and risk also jumped like that. And funnily enough, so too did the troubles that came along with that.
Okay, so that's a really interesting thing. We haven't spoken about this before, so I'm really curious to understand that. When you went from 3 to 1 to 1 to 11, what structures did you have in place to deal with that? Or were there none? Or was it just a case of catch Les in the corridor while he's on roller skates going from one room to the next? And, you know, in those early days, I know you've got a lot of structures now, so I know you're really all over it, and I want to ask about the difference and the learnings that you've had to put in place.
Yeah, well, that was winging it, mate. That's what that was. That was winging it. There were no structures in place. I didn't see that coming. You had a good question. The question was, you know, what didn't you see? What blindsided you? That blindsided me. I certainly didn't see that coming. And I think what that became was the steroid course on leadership and management and jump in the deep end and keep your head above water, otherwise you're going to drown. There was no choice.
Yeah. And here's my question for you, Les. Do you think that most people, when they take over a business, they get blindsided by one thing or another? It might be something different. But for me, in my experience, whenever I've taken on a new project or taken over a new business, something unexpected happens, for sure, for me, and I'm blindsided by something. Do you reckon, I'm interested in your perspective, do you reckon that's just you and me, or do you reckon that's a general thing?
Jesse, I'd worked there, I think I'd started working there part-time in 1996 or something, and I didn't become the sole owner until 2011. So I'd worked there for 15 years. I knew the business pretty well. So I don't think there was a lot of inherent risk because I knew it so well. But it was a lack of experience that led to that. In hindsight now, I can see it coming a mile away. But at the time, your youth, your lack of experience, and it's like anything, probably was lacking a mentor at the time. The other guys weren't bad. I'm not trying to say they left me high and dry. But at the same time, they were all partners as well, so they still had each other to, and friends at that, and they all, and we all had each other to rely on. So I don't think there was ever a point in time where any of them were sort of the 1 to 10 ratio that I spoke about. Didn't see it coming because of my lack of experience. I think I would now, second time around, and that's what it comes to.
All right. So, mate, contrast that to today. Now you've got probably more support staff these days than you had back then. I'm curious to understand how your structures are now in comparison to, you know, that those early days? What have you put in place in terms of dealing with that 1 to 11 or 1 to 15 kind of thing? So, again, the lesson for those people who might be going, oh, my goodness, he's just speaking to me. Now, how did he solve it?
Yeah, so, look, Jesse, I think you and I both know what version I'm up to on the org chart, and that's the first thing that comes to mind. It's the organisational chart, which is plays a massive role. Having the positions in there and filling the positions with the best people, as opposed to trying to move the org chart around to suit the people. And that's what serves the workplace, and that's what serves the business, and that's what serves the team. It's the way I compare it to my team is like I play soccer and I like soccer, and you've got a goalkeeper, you've got a striker, you've got a defence, you've got an attack. Everyone wants to be the striker and score goals, but, you know, without the goalkeeper, you're not going to win too many games. Every person has those roles to play, putting them in the best positions that their strengths are going to play to, and at the same time support the team and the team environment, and making those position descriptions very, very clear. So everybody knows what their role is and everybody knows what's expected of them.
Okay, so it sounds like you've put in place a lot more structure around that, and I know, am I allowed to say what version org chart we're up to?
It's a dynamic, evolving thing.
Well, it's never done, isn't it? Because the business continues to change and grow. So, and that's the way it should be. So I think it's up to a version 11 or 12. I can't remember. But anyway, there's been a few iterations. And one of the things I really like that you said, Les, which I think for anyone listening is a really important insight that Les has shared, and that is he's constructed his organizational chart around the positions on the field rather than the people on the team. And so I think that's a really key and important point. And it was a bit like when I was in the Navy as well, mate. When I'd moved from one job to the other, the job wasn't created to suit me. I just moved into a new role. And so I think one of the big mistakes I see in practice is people saying, oh, this is Susie's role, or this is Mary's role, or this is Bobby's role, or whatever. And it's not Mary, Susie's, or Bobby's role. It's a position. So I think that's a key insight you shared. So, Les, you've gone from 3-1 to 10-1, and you're now dealing with lots of staff, lots of complexity, lots of issues. What other things cropped up for you in that journey as you took on the role of sole owner in the practice?
Look, it's a really good question, and it's sort of how far back does my memory go? I think...
Hopefully it hasn't been blocked out.
Sorry?
Hopefully you haven't blocked it out.
Yeah, with respect to, if you're talking about principles, it's probably about... You know, you might have this business plan or this goal, and you've got this direction that you want to head into. And sometimes you get that flywheel going and it starts turning and things are moving forward at a really good rate. Then something goes into the cogs and they cease, and you end up either not going as rapidly forward as you thought, or maybe having to take a step backwards in order to keep moving forwards. And it's about accepting there are certain challenges that will pop up and rise, and dealing with them as it comes up.
Okay, so I'm aware of some of the challenges. You know, we obviously work together, and I'm aware of some of the challenges that you've faced over the last year or two or three. And one of the things I really admire about you, Les, is your ability to grit, resilience, right, to be able to get through things. So, you know, one of the happy things in life is to have families and kids and so on. But when you've got a couple of staff members who are all pregnant at the same time, it's obviously really happy for them, and we're obviously thrilled and excited for them on a personal level. But it does throw a little bit of chaos into the team structure, right?
Yeah. So we're talking about the org chart position descriptions and having that org chart set up. So you've got, as you like to call it, bench warmers or second in charge. So they're up and coming through the ranks so that they can basically help those other people have holidays and fill in their role, and so duties still get done when certain people are away. There was a point in time where I had some senior team members pregnant, so sure enough, we put other relatively senior team members as their understudies who then got pregnant, and then sort of it happened again and again and again. So as much as I had planned and thought out who the best people were to fill certain roles, if you want to include my wife in there, within the last 12 months, four people got pregnant and had babies. And it's just something you can't plan for. And it's something that, let's say you've got a team of 9 support staff, that's a third that get changed over.
Yeah. So again, here's the thing around that, Les, is because even with the best planning, contingencies in place, understudies in place, things still happen, right? Things from left field still happen. So my question to you, Les, is yes, I know we had the best plans in place, and I know that even with those good plans, more people felt pregnant than was anticipated. I want to tap into resilience for a second, Les, because I think that did put a lot of pressure on the existing team and by extension you. So I want to talk about digging deep and finding those inner reserves, because you had to do that. And I'm just curious to ask you, A, how you did that and where did you find those reserves?
It's a very good question. And to try to be as honest and open as I can about it, I think it comes down to your core values. It comes down to your beliefs. It comes down to the foundations that you pin yourself on. I always held myself accountable to myself. I always knew the direction I wanted to go in. Didn't see certain obstacles come in my way like that, like at one stage, you know, there's three senior team members got pregnant and left within a month of each other. And then trying to, there's the saying, you want to hire slow and fire fast if they're not the right fit. Trying to maintain that team culture. In amongst that, we sort of had, as much as we were planning to fill those roles, maybe it was my HR selection that wasn't appropriate, but we sort of had a fair number of new recruits that didn't work out and weren't the right fit for us. They're probably perfect for another practice, but not for us. And that's what put a lot of stress and strain. So that caused some strain on myself and on the rest of the team, because they were carrying the load when the others weren't there to help them. But at the same time, the vision was always clear as to which direction we were heading in. Everybody knew right from wrong. Everybody knew the integrity and those values which underpinned what we did and why we did the things we did. And as a result, when you know something's right, you can easily keep going. And there's that saying that I know I've told you, what do they say? If you're going through hell, don't stop.
Yeah, let's get there quickly. Get through the other side. So you spoke there, Les, about core values and what you pin yourself to. And I guess, you know, anyone listening to this show is going to go, yeah, we get the core values piece. We understand the culture and how important that is. But what I think that you've done really, really well is you've been able to make culture come alive. It's not just a placard on a wall. It's not a mission statement that's gathering dust. It's something that you come back to again and again, and you use it for a decision-making framework. So you make decisions using your culture and your values as a matrix, or as a, I suppose, a decision-making tool. I wanted to ask you how you went through the process of gaining clarity in that area. Is it something that you're always clear about, or is it something that you had to work on, or what was that journey like for you personally?
As far as establishing the core values, one of my favorite self-development books of all time is, or the authors are Stephen Covey. And I remember at the time reading The 7 Habits, Stephen Covey, and at the time using that book to establish my own personal mission statement, having undertaken other self-development courses and reading other books, it was a matter of then disseminating that stuff to the rest of the team. You know, looking at things like the human needs and morals and ethics and to live, to love, to learn, to leave a legacy, all that sort of stuff, our whys, what we do, how we do it, why we do it. And after getting the team involved on that and getting them up to speed to a certain level, sitting down together and saying, okay, what is important to us? What are we here for? Are we here for consumption? Are we here for contribution? And then establishing sort of half a dozen core values. We've got about 7 now. I'm trying to keep it down. They want to keep going, but we're just trying to keep saying no and amalgamating them. But I did involve the team very heavily when we first established them, and everybody resonated with them. I mean, we literally had a consensus, and everybody's input was taken into consideration, and to some degree a part of everybody's input was placed into the development of the actual core values. Now, that was 10 years ago. You know, the mission statement's still evolving. It has evolved. It's not something that I just established overnight because I sat down and wrote it out. It's something we just keep refining and honing. But with that said, that original team that we established the core values with, there's been a changing of the guard too. And as we recruit new team members, they usually align themselves with those core values pretty quickly, which is what underpins the team culture. And then that's what will generally determine they're going to stay for a while or not stay.
And have you ever had that situation? We talk about the performance culture matrix a bit, you know, the ABCD grid. So for anyone listening, it's a 2x2 matrix, performance measured on the vertical axis and culture fit measured on the horizontal axis. So top right quadrant is an A player, you know, great at the job, great culture fit. B player is bottom right, so great culture fit, just need a bit of work in their skills or consistency perhaps. A C player is someone who's actually really technically competent but not quite a culture fit. And a D player is someone who's neither a culture fit or not particularly skilled in their role. And we've spoken in the past about A's, B's, C's and D's. And for me, in my experience, a C player has been the hardest one to deal with, where they're really good at their role, but for one reason or another, we thought they were going to be a good culture fit, but it just hasn't quite worked out that way. Have you had to, you know, you've had your practice now for a number of years. I know you've got an awesome team now, so it doesn't relate to anyone there. But in the past, have you had to deal with that? And I guess my question for you is, what lessons came out of that in terms of moving forward with recruitment, moving forward with training, and as you said earlier, you know, hire slowly and fire quickly. What's been your experience in trying to get that culture fit right?
I think one of the first things is expressing those core values to future team members up early and early in the day, and getting them, seeing their reaction to it and seeing if it's something that they do or don't resonate with. Reflecting on them yourself a lot, not just having them there on a piece of paper and forgetting about them. And when it comes to that ABCD matrix, you're usually sort of finding out pretty quick, by pretty quick, within the first few months, if I'm going to say a time frame, where you get a pretty good indication whether someone is going to fit into that culture long term or not. And usually they have a feel for it themselves.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? They know whether they're fitting in or not. And mate, I've been the C player in a practice before where, you know, I was going along all right in my role, but in terms of the fit, I was the square peg in the round hole. So just to be clear, for anyone listening, it's not that a C player or a D player even is a bad person. They might be great people, but not necessarily the right people. So Les, you've got a wonderful team now, and clearly that hasn't happened by accident. And I know that you've worked really hard to find and recruit and retain some wonderful people on your team. In terms of just to wrap up the whole section on team for a second, what's been your experience in building such a strong team? Obviously, at the present time, you've got an exceptional team. You've worked hard to build a world-class team. And I know that you've put a lot of thought, a lot of conscious effort into it. And I guess what I'm just trying to draw out from you in this conversation is if you had any particular tips or advice or insights or lessons, whether they come from good experiences or even missteps along the way, what advice would you have to someone who's now thinking, I've got to try and build myself a world-class team, and how important has that been for you and your success?
Jim Collins wrote that book, Good to Great, and he talks about getting the right people on the bus to start off. He's more easily said than done. You don't necessarily know the right people are on the bus until they're on sometimes, and then you've got to get them in the right seats. And I suppose the first part of it is just understanding when the right people are on there and when the wrong people are on there.
Les, reflecting on your journey building that team, what would be, you know, one piece of advice you might proffer to people listening to the podcast that has served you well?
Yeah, the one piece of advice is lead from the front. Don't expect anybody to do anything you don't want to do yourself. You know, if the garbage bags have got to be taken down, then I'll take the garbage bags down. But at the same time, if my time needs to be spent doing something that nobody else can do, and if somebody else to do that, well, that needs to be taken into consideration as well. But I think I would like to think that my entire team understands that there's nothing I would expect them to do that I wouldn't do myself, should the need arise.
Yeah. Ah, fantastic. So, ladies and gents, some wonderful words of advice there. I'd really encourage you to hit pause, go back, have a listen to Les's insights and wisdom again, because, again, some of these lessons have come along easily enough, but some of them, I can guarantee, have been hard fought and hard won. So one of the things that I always look for is someone who can pave the way for me, and Les is doing exactly that in this conversation. Les, I want to switch gear for a second. You're a family man. You've got 5 wonderful children, a lovely wife, and that's a pretty full existence, mate. There's a lot on your plate.
And I've got to thank my wife for that.
Yeah, she is a tremendous support to you, I know. But again, there's a lot of people wondering, how do I have a life and a business? Because for some people, it seems to be one or the other. And yeah, definitely there are times when there's emphasis in one space or another. But I wanted to ask you your thoughts around how you've been able to create such a large and wonderful family while at the same time growing your business.
Yeah, look, you've taught me that one, mate. Back in the early days when we talked about the default diary, something we've forgotten about and don't talk about too much, but trying to segment your time and allot it to certain hats that we wear during our lives. I don't know if true balance, where you're juggling all the balls in the air at once, ever really happens. But what I do think is that you'll be focusing on certain areas without taking the pulse off the others. Still being wary of those. For example, you might be heavily, I'm having babies, I might be heavily focused on looking after my family, but don't take the finger off the pulse of the business. And then vice versa, the business might need us. There might be some team challenges or something like that. And that stresses everybody out. And the last thing you want to do is then stress the family at home. So it's a matter of making sure that you're sort of using the elasticity that's there, but not breaking it beyond breaking point.
Yeah, cool. And again, I really like what you said, mate, is when you've got your dad hat on, you're dad. When you've got your business hat on, you're in business mode. So it's quarantining that time and partitioning that time, and having the default diary, I think, is a really useful thing. And yours, again, I've seen it many times, is quite well structured. I also just wanted to ask you, Les, about the importance of self-reflection. Know thyself. And we have lots of conversations, obviously, and one of the things that I've always been impressed about, Les, is your ability to know yourself. And that means, in the nicest way, the good, bad, and the ugly, right? We know what we're good at, we know what we're not good at, we know whatever. So I wanted to ask you where self-reflection has served you in running your business, because I don't know that everyone spends enough time in that quiet moment of reflection doing some critical thinking and really kind of diving down into some of those things, that rather than just giving it a cursory glance. We live in a world where attention span is short, but what I admire about you is you give things critical thought and self-reflection. So I'm wondering if you could just speak to that for a moment.
I think that's multifaceted, but one aspect is how many things can you control, really control? And I still have trouble controlling myself many times over, but that's one thing that you can try to take charge of, and you can try to control, and you'll have as much level of success as you really want to have. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's something that no one else can do greater than or better than you. And if you're faced with a certain challenge or a certain situation, usually it's the way that it's interpreted which will determine how you come out the other end. It's the way that you see it which is going to determine the way that you deal with it, and the level of responsibility you take for either being there or facing it. I don't know how to give it like a practical bit of advice on how you actually do that. It's a matter of being accountable to yourself and trying to be true to yourself and trying to see, there's that gap between something that happens and the response that you're going to give it. Are you going to just react without thinking? Are you going to sort of sit there and think, well, what have I done to contribute to this thing and what can I do to make it better, even if I'm not the one that made it happen?
Again, I think that's really profound and really wise as well. So again, ladies and gents, I'd encourage you to write that down, just to pause. The power of that pause when something happens, to stop, reflect, and respond rather than just getting caught up in the story and the emotion of it all and reacting. Self-reflection has obviously been an important part of your journey, Les, and critical thinking and really applying, I suppose, a great deal of consideration to all that you do. When it's come to your time to reflect on your business and you think about those things, I always think that running a business is possibly one of the hardest things in life, coming up to raising a family. They teach you a lot, right? And raising a family is sometimes messy, sometimes chaotic, wonderful, stressful, and all those things. What is it that you've learned from your business? What has your business taught you about you or about the world in general?
I know that work is good for you. I think that it stimulates you in so many ways that I know personally I wouldn't necessarily had the same level of self-reflection or pursued the same level of self-development or leadership, because may not have necessarily been able to apply it. Whereas I think running and owning a business is something that gives you, it's like the school of hard knocks, so to speak, where you're thrown in the deep end and you better keep your head above water and swim, and you've got to learn how to deal with those things that are thrown at you on a day-to-day basis. And unless you want to keep facing the same problems, you better learn what caused it in the first place to prevent it from coming next time. So that self-development and that self-reflection and that trying to make yourself a better man or woman, whatever the case may be, is something that becomes inherent in owning a business, I think. I don't think you will ever get to the next level until you've gotten your personal development to the next level. I think you've taught me that the growth of the business is limited to the growth of the owner, and I believe in that firmly.
Well, mate, your business is growing a lot, and that's probably because you're growing a lot, mate, and it's been a pleasure to witness that. One of the things as well is I just want to change tack for a second, mate, because we've been quite philosophical and quite high level at the moment. We're talking helicopter view kind of things for the business. I do want to get down and dirty in some nitty-gritty for a second, because, again, it's one thing to take that high helicopter view and be strategic, which we've spoken about today, and I think the personal development piece of that is critically important. But I want to also tap into one of your great strengths as well, and that is understanding metrics and knowing what to measure and how to interpret that data, because not everything that matters can be measured, and not everything that's measured matters. So tell me a little bit about numbers for you, mate. Where do they fit into your ability to run your business?
Well, I suppose one of the first questions you asked me on the podcast was one of the things that blindsided me that I didn't see. And another thing was, back then when we had the partnership, we sort of all took on different roles and wore different hats, where one of the other guys was looking at the finances, etc. I never really worried about it. And all of a sudden, there came a point in time where I had to, and I was like a lemming about to jump off the end of a cliff. And I've got one of my good mates, Anoop. He was a business coach at the time, and he encouraged me to do one of his courses. And that's when I really learned the power of metrics and tracking and measuring. And ever since, I never looked back. It was like it was a way of going from something you think you know and something that you feel to something you can quantitatively nail and measure and know which button to push, which lever to pull to get the result you wanted. And without measuring it, you just don't know.
So one of the things we spoke about today, just as an example, was you looked at your postage.
Yeah, so funny enough, we try to follow a nice strict reminder and recall system. We track our expenses pretty well every month, and I look at them and I notice that postage was running low, and I was thinking that's weird, because it was really low. It was like a quarter of what it normally is or should be. And then it started me thinking, well, how many of those reminders are we sending out then? Now, it might be old school, of course, you can do it by email, but our system involved mail. So it was a way of me going, hey, there's something wrong here. And then one thing added up to the other, where if they're not getting sent out, people aren't getting the reminders, and therefore we're going to have a lot more cancellations or fail to attend. Sure enough, when I then dwelled into that number, it was higher than it normally would be. So it enabled us to fix that problem, which otherwise would have flown under the radar.
One of the things with that number that I really like, Les, is that you pulled on that thread and you pulled to see where it went, and you kept on pulling it, because at first glance, you could kind of go, or you could be forgiven for saying, hey, my postage is like, you beauty, we got a deal. But you were curious enough to ask the question why and why and why. And, of course, that led further and further upstream to the actual root cause. So, really, again, I appreciate your ability to read numbers and get the story that's happening. Metrics, I'm a bit of an Excel nerd. You know, I love a good spreadsheet. It kind of means I don't have too many friends and my social lives are fairly limited. You're hanging out with the Microsoft online chat forums. But I'm curious to ask you, Les, again, in your journey of learning more about your business, learning more about metrics, learning more about taking the pulse of your business, because you've used that term before, you know, keeping your finger on the pulse while your attention's elsewhere. How have you managed to do that? Is it just metrics or is it other things that you're looking at as well?
I think metrics is the most important part because they're tangible. You can measure them, you can see them, and they don't lie. They provided you track them properly. They're telling you exactly what's happening. You can go the other way and have that paralysis by analysis where you're just tracking too much stuff and what the hell are you tracking it for, you know, if you can't. And analyze it through some of the conversations we've had before. I think, you know, I still use my gut feeling to a degree. You just can't substitute that for anything else. I think the numbers help confirm and help verify, but there's this certain degree of your subconscious telling you something's right or something's wrong that you've got to listen to as well.
Yeah, I really resonate with that because one of the things that I find as well is sometimes my little antenna's firing, I'm going, this just doesn't feel right or it just doesn't add up. And there's just that moment of going, this got to check this out a bit more. And sure enough, when you then use the metrics in conjunction, you kind of go, ha, knew something was wrong or that just didn't feel right from the outset. Now I know. Les, one of the things that I know about you is you've had some wonderful influences in your life. I know there's been some people who have had a tremendous impact on you and your journey. And I'm curious to ask you what you've learned from those people along the way. Who's been the biggest influence in your life when it comes to, you know, running a business and by extension creating a life that you now lead?
That's a tough one, Jesse, because it depends on what aspect we're talking about. Now, I'm a practicing Christian, and that's a big part of my life, and that's one of those underpinning foundations that guide me on a day-to-day basis. Ultimately, going back to quote Stephen Covey, begin with the end in mind. So for me, my spiritual journey is just probably it's the most important journey, and it's the thing that guides everything else. And I'm trying to answer this question, geez, in a pretty practical way. But at the end of the day, it's going to be, if we're talking about life in general, it's usually spiritual guidance I get from those around me, like my spiritual father from my church. If we're talking about self-development influences, I've done just about every Tony Robbins course there is, and I think they've helped me a lot. Has he been a personal mentor? No, because wouldn't be able to get the access to him. But you learn something from just about everybody, especially those who've already been there and done it. And it's just a matter of ears wide open and taking what you can.
Let me ask you a leading question. I know you've grown up in a family business. I know that, you know, your dad's been an incredibly large figure in your life. What is it that you learned kind of just by sitting at your father's knee around business and life and growing up?
Yeah, okay. My father's taught me a lot. It's a really good question. My father is somebody I look up to. He's somebody that I've been blessed to have guide me. He's a man who left his native country. He's Lebanese, so he left Lebanon and came to Australia. I don't even know if he could speak much English. He's had half a dozen different businesses in different sectors, from dry cleaning to real estate to running hotels and motels and pubs and you name it. He's done it, and he's done it successfully. I'm one of six kids, so he's done that having a family of eight. And he's done it across just about every state in Australia as well. And when I've tracked his story, you just see that's the definition of resilience. And that's a definition of persistence. And that's a definition of backing yourself. He's just said, I'm going to do it. and then knuckled down and got the job done. And I admire him for that. And hopefully some of that has rubbed off onto me, but definitely not as much as what he had.
Well, mate, I think a fair bits are rubbed off, mate. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree, that's for sure. Well done, you. Hey, Les, you've been incredibly generous with your time tonight, mate. And I want to thank you for being such a good sport and coming onto our show to share so openly, so freely, and so generously your story, your wins, your lessons, because I know that from this podcast, it'll be a little ripple. You know, you drop the pebble in the pond and the ripple spread out, and you never know quite where that ripple's going to take a hold. And I know that tonight someone will be listening to this podcast and going, thank goodness for Les Jabeur. And and from all of us here, mate, thank you. You're a gem.
Thank you, Jesse. It was a pleasure and a privilege, mate.
You're a champ. Cheers, mate.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/savvydentist.